Yeah, thanks everyone for coming. So today's talk was going to follow on from the talk I gave here previously on whether certain operations in quantum field theory respect relativistic causality. One of the open questions in that talk was what happens in the case of ideal or projective measurements? And so that's going to be our kind of main goal that we're working towards today. I also just realized the date is wrong, and that's a completely honest mistake there. Not a joke about causality in any way. all right, so let me just set the scene for this whole problem. Textbook measurements in quantum field theory, the textbook description of measurements for use in collider experiments and whatnot is usually in terms of scattering amplitudes, which are derived in the theory with this approximation that the state comes in from the infinite past, interacts at some point, and then we look at what comes out in the infinite future, roughly speaking. In reality, you know, experiments will happen in some finite duration of time and in some finite region of space. So what happens if we try and use the textbook description of measurements to describe, say, multiple measurements in a QFT context, which are all happening in finite regions of space-time? And it turns out we run into certain issues with causality. What do I mean when I say the textbook description of measurements? I'm talking about really kind of two things: how we compute probabilities of outcomes, the Born rule, etc., expectation values and whatnot, and two, how we encode the effect of our present measurement on the statistics, the probabilities of outcomes of any future measurements. And in general, we do that with an update map or a quantum channel, as it's also called. but an update map is only really required if we're talking about multiple measurements on the same system, because the job of the update map is to tell us how the statistic, so how our present measurement is changing the statistics of any future measurements. So an example is the ideal measurement update map that comes from the projection postulate. And in 1993, I think Raphael Sorkin was the first to point out that for certain non-local observables in quantum field theory, the ideal measurement update map leads to causality violations in the form of superluminal signals between two parties. So clearly that's not good. That's an impossibility we don't want to go down. So we take that to mean that the ideal measurement map for those non-local observables in QFT is just not physically realizable by any process. and that's not true of every update map. And so the question that I'm interested in is then, what is the mathematical space of update maps in QFT that are consistent with relativistic causality? As those are the maps that are, at least in principle, physically realizable. So I should also mention some other types of update maps that come up. There are those that come from coupling in some probe to the main quantum field of interest, measuring the probe, and then tracing it out. So this could be, the probe could be an Unruh de Witt detector or a probe quantum field itself. And usually what happens is we measure the probe just once, and we then trace it out. And so there's not really any need, because we only have one measurement then on the probe, there's no need for an update map to describe the how the statistics are changed of future measurements on the probe, because we only measure it once. We do still have the update map, though, on the main system of interest, because that comes from us tracing out this probe, whatever it is. Now, to get multiple measurements on the main field of interest, we imagine then having multiple probes. So it could be multiple probe quantum fields, and we measure each one just once and then trace it out. These probes are effective systems. A probe quantum field, for example, is an effective field. It can't be a fundamental or standard model field because, well, we can't go introducing a new standard model field for every time we want to measure some other main field of interest. There's only a handful of standard model fields to go around. but even thinking of these probes or probe fields as effective fields, if we're for a given effective field, it arises from some degrees of freedom of some set of fundamental fields in some limit. So when we're talking about multiple measurements, each on a different effective probe field, then at a fundamental level, we're talking about multiple measurements on the same set of fundamental fields. And so by two, we then have to go back and think about update maps on that set of fundamental fields. So it seems like we're always coming back to this question then of discussing update maps in QFT, whether or not they're on, it could be on these fundamental fields, say, and it would be nice to know what the space of causally consistent maps are. Furthermore, thinking about this question, we might be led to some principle that's analogous to the projection postulate that tells us how to describe measurements in QFT in a causally consistent manner without reference to any probe or auxiliary system, just as the projection postulate does for us in non-relativistic QFT. It might be the case that the projection postulate already does the job in QFT, certainly not for the non-local observables that Raphael looked at that violated causality, but maybe for some local observables, the projection postulate will be consistent with causality. So that's the plan we'll find out today. But first, I just want to recap some of the things I said in my previous talk, go over Sorkin's scenario, and talk about the conditions on the update map, specifically the causality condition that I'm referring to when I say a map is causal or acausal. And after that, I'll then, for the second part of the talk, go into the specific case of ideal measurements, which will require some background first of all. I'll then cast the form of the update map into this more general form, which I've just termed Krauss operations. And the reason for doing that is because it will allow us to get a causality condition that's a little more readily useful than the causality condition for the case of a general update map. And with that, then we can try and answer this question of whether or not ideal measurements are causal. Okay, so the first thing is just a lightning review of quantum field theory. And I'll be sticking to real scalar field theory, a free theory as well, not interacting in some globally hyperbolic spacetime. The operator algebra A is generated with the identity operator and these things called smeared field operators. So 5F, where F is a test function, that is a smooth function that is compactly supported in space and time. So if you want, you can think about it like this. We are integrating against this test function the what's usually called the field operator in QFT textbooks, but is technically an operator value distribution. To get an operator in the theory, you have to integrate phi of tx against some test function. So for different test functions then supported in, say, some different regions, then we can look at all sorts of possible operators we can get by multiplying them, adding them up with the identity as well. That's just an example. But we can also consider functions of these operators, so the complex exponential function of some smeared field. An important point to note is the commutation relations between two smeared fields. So what we get back here is the something proportional to the identity, and the proportionality constant is the Pauli-Jordan function, but smeared over or integrated against two test functions, f and g. And what's nice about this is that when the test functions are space-like separated, or their supports are space-like separated, causally disconnected, then Pauli-Jordan function vanishes, and so the two smeared fields commute. And I'm going to call this space-like commutativity, or it's also known, Einstein causality. And then from this, we can say that for any operators that are built from smeared fields in two different space-like regions, they will commute. And that's kind of the defining property of what I mean by a local observable in the theory, if it's built from these phis. Okay, so the final thing to mention is that we are imagining we have some candidate state in the theory omega, which we can think of as the ground state. And it has this two-point function w, and from that we can get any other endpoint functions in the theory in the usual way. So we're imagining the state is Gaussian. Okay, so that's everything we guess need to know about quantum field theory to get on with some calculations. So first, I'm going to describe what I mean by a local operation in the theory. So let's say we've got some local observable C generated from smeared fields local into this region, and we want to measure that. By measuring it without conditioning on any outcome or post-selecting on any outcome, that will, in general, change the statistics of any future measurements. And so we can describe that with an update map, E sub with a subscript C, that acts on the operator algebra A. And so when I say on any future measurements, I'm thinking if we have an observable B that's not to the past of this region for C, then when we come to compute its expectation value, we do that not with B, but with EC on B. So this will potentially be some different operator, And rho here is just the global state of the system. So just for an example, if we have an ideal measurement where C can be diagonalized, so written as a sum over distinct eigenvalues times the associated projectors, then the update map is explicitly this sum over the projectors acting on either side of B. And this is probably familiar, or the dual picture is familiar to people, where we act not on the operators, but on the density matrix rho in this form. But for convenience, or it seemed more convenient for me, to stick in the dual picture to this, where we're acting not on rho, but on the operators. But the idea is that the two pictures are equivalent when looking at, say, expectation values. Okay, so in this way, we're encoding the statistics, or how the statistics are changed for future measurements, given that we did some measurement of C down here. Just for some more examples of update maps, we don't just have to think about measurements, we can think about other operations. So here's what I'm calling a unitary kick with respect to C, where we hit B on either side with unitaries constructed from C. And I'm going to give that a spectral symbol U for unitary. Just another example is a weak measurement update map. So weak measurements normally arise, or this update map normally arises from coupling the main system to some other auxiliary system and then tracing out the auxiliary system. But we're not going to assume anything like that here. I'm taking an operationalist perspective where I'm just imagining that we do something to the system that results in this form of the update map. Again, I'm going to give this a special symbol, W for weak measurement, and give it a superscript sigma, which is the width of the Gaussians that appear in this form of the update map. Okay, so a nice feature of the update maps that I've just shown you is that if the observable B is space-like to C, then C and B commute by space-like commutativity, and this ensures that the update map, when it acts on B, it will act trivially, as in it just spits out B again. And this is what I'm going to call the locality of the map. The map is local if it does this. And physically, this encodes the fact that expectation values are unchanged whenever we're talking about, expectation values are unchanged by operations happening in space-like regions. so just I was just taking the trace with rho on either side there, and you can see explicitly what I mean by expectation values not being changed. Okay, so now what happens if we have multiple local operations rather than just one? The general framework for this was, at least in the QFT context, was first laid out by Helwig and Krauss. so if we have some operation first with respect to an observable A, and then we have an operation with respect to C, and then we want to work out what are the expectation values of observables at some point in the future, what we do is compute the expectation value with the composition of EC and EA. And we're doing that in this order, which may look backwards, because we're doing because we're sitting in this dual picture where we act with the update maps on the operators as opposed to the states. In the dual picture, we would be acting with EA or EA tilde on rho first and then EC tilde on rho. And another nice feature of the maps that the examples I've given you so far is that if the two regions are space-like to one another, then the two update maps commute when acting on the space of operators. And that means that it doesn't matter which way we compose them. And this physically makes sense. There's no canonical way to order these two regions in space-time, and so it shouldn't matter which way we compose these maps. And this is, again, ensured for us going all the way by the property of space-like commutativity we talked about in the beginning. Okay, so with that, now we can move to Sorokin's scenario going back to 1993. So imagine we have three agents, and I was doing this work in Ireland, so I'm kind of stuck with these Irish names now. We have Aoife, who does some operation in this region, Cuiva, who does some operation in this region, and then Biola, who measures some observable up here. so if we were going to work out, one thing to note, the specific space-time setup of these regions is such that this region up here for Biola is space-like to Aoife's region, causally disconnected. But they are both time-like related to Cuiva's region in the middle. So the composition rule from before says that if we're computing expectation values of B, we do that with this particular composition, EC first and then EA. But physically, we don't expect the expectation value of an observable here to depend on IFA's operation. That is, it should just be the same as if IFA wasn't doing anything at all. And in that case, we just get trace row of EC on B. But, and so we expect this equality, that the trace row of the composition should just be the same as trace row of EC on B. But the space-like commutativity property that's been really nice so far does not ensure this equality anymore in general. And further, if this equality is not satisfied, then IFA and Biola can exploit this whole scenario and come up with a protocol where IFA can send a signal, a single bit of information to Biola. Specifically, Biola can just measure the expectation value and, you know, they'll see a difference whether or not IFA does something or she doesn't do something, and that could correspond to a binary, a bit one that IFA is trying to send or a bit zero. And so if they do enough runs of this experiment, which they could do in parallel, then Biola can build up the statistics to tell whether or not IFA is or is not doing something. But the important thing to note is that because we started with Biola being space-like to IFA, this signal that's being sent must travel superluminally, faster than light. And that clearly can't happen. And so this update map that we're talking about in the middle, which is enabling all of this kind of the situation to go down, if we get this inequality here, then that update map could not correspond to any physical process that Quiva could actually implement. So for any physical process, Quiva's map must satisfy this constraint. And we also don't want this constraint to be not satisfied for a particular state, because then they could just prepare that initial global state at the beginning and then send a faster than light signal. So we're asking for this to be true for all states row. But I'm just going to underline that and put a pin in that comment for all states. And I'll come back to that in a second. But assuming that we get this for all states, then we can show the corresponding operator equality, that the operators that you get on either side must be the same. And this was a causality condition on Quiva's map with respect to the map or the operation that IFA does and the operator that Biola is measuring. So another interesting thing is that this causality condition we're thinking about for Quiva's map doesn't depend on the map being local to any region. We could imagine update maps that are completely non-local, go across the entirety of space, and still ask whether or not they satisfy this operator equality. And actually, this idea of the causality condition we have being separate from the locality condition we had from before is analogous to work that was done by Beckman and Presco and Gottesman and Nielsen back in 2001, where they looked at bipartite Hilbert space and looked at what operations can be done on the combined Hilbert space that don't enable a signal from one party on part one of the Hilbert space to one party in part B of the Hilbert space. And they found as well that there was these properties of causal and local of the maps that were separate or were distinct. Okay, so I thought it'd be good now to just sort of summarize those properties and everything I've said so far in just one slide. So we have operations by Quiva given by these update maps, and the locality condition that I mentioned before is where the update map will act trivially on B if B is space-like to C. And this, for the maps that we looked at anyway, was already implied or given to us for free by the property of space-like commutativity. I was talking about this causality property, and remember this equality came from assuming the expectation values were equal for all states row. And now the actual causality condition is really that we want this to be true for anything that IFA can do and anything that Biola can measure. So we're saying we want this equality for all A not in the future of C, all B not in the past of C, and assuming A and B are space-like separated. That is what we mean by the causality of the map EC. that it does not enable a superluminal signal in kind of any scenario. Also assumed in here is that the map EA is local to whatever region, as in it satisfies the same property, but we're just talking about EA. Okay, so with those two conditions, locality and causality, we can draw a nice Venn diagram in the space of all completely positive and unit-preserving maps in QFT. Unit-preserving here because we're in the dual picture. So rather than talking about trace-preserving, we're unit-preserving. So here's the bubble for causal, and here's the bubble for local. And the first example that's both causal and local, and remember, or I should say, that the intersection here are the ones that we would think of as being physically realizable, the ones that can be implemented in principle in some finite space-time region and do not enable pathological superluminal signals. So the first example is this unitary kick from before, but specifically with one of the generators of the operator algebra, the smeared field 5F. So here's the explicit form of that map, just to remind you. Now, if I look at the way that this map acts in the dual picture, so how it acts on the states, it has this simple form where we hit any state psi with the corresponding exponential. And this map, I think, can be implemented by just adding to the Lagrangian a term which is something like some external field. In this case, it would be the F coupled to the field phi. So it's like turning on an external field and coupling it to the quantum field of interest. Okay, another example of a causal and local map is the weak measurement map from before, specifically with the smeared field 5F. Here's its form, just to remind you what that looks like. And we can fill out all the areas of this diagram with examples. So an example of a map that is local, but not causal, and so not physically realizable, is a unitary kick, but with the smeared field squared instead. And I've written down its action in the dual picture on a state psi, just to go back to the point I made before about saying that, you know, we got this condition by requiring it to be the case for all states rho, or that expectation values were equal for all states rho. But now we see a state, so pick some psi, could be the ground state, act on it with this unitary, you get a well-defined state in the theory, but it looks like that's a state that to get to it from, say, the ground state, you would have to do something that would enable a superluminal signal. So it doesn't feel like, you know, that seems to be on some shaky ground there, whether or not we should consider states like this. So, so if you were to try and write this down in Lagrangian formalism, or write a Lagrangian that you're going to exponentiate to get the unitary that evolves this system, you would have terms, you know, if I expand out 5f in that form of the integral, you get these non-local terms, yeah.
If instead of that square, you would do the energy momentum tensor, for instance, which is a local quadratic term, then that would be fine.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I haven't checked that. Yeah. Yeah. And
so
I.
So it's more about the locality.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's just me putting a pin in this point about. For all states, rho, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to try and address that when we come to the case of ideal measurements. So other examples are, again, the weak measurement update map, but now with 5f squared. We can also come up with maps that are causal, but not local. So you can kind of think of these as where you take a test function and then stretch it out over all of space. you would get something that looks like these update maps. They don't enable any superluminal signals, but they can't be implemented in a finite region of space. And you can also do the same thing, but for these maps, you can stretch out the test function to get maps that are not causal and not local. okay, so another interesting condition on these maps that straightforwardly implies the causality condition is what I was calling path support non-increasing, or PSNI. So what does it mean diagrammatically? If we act with EC on B, then the map EC is PSNI if the resulting operator you get can be localized in any region down here whose future domain of dependence contains the region for B. So that's what PSNI means, and it trivially, well, sort of trivially implies the causality condition, and for any number of maps that you string on the end here, not just one. And so it implies causality and hence sits inside this bubble and actually includes the examples I've given. And one of the main results I'd say from the paper is that causality is the same as this PSNI condition. And that was what we were able to I was able to show for the case of real scalar field theory. So another condition I want to bring up is a stricter one, that of support non-increasing. So in this case, EC on B gives an operator that can actually just be localized in the exact same region as B if you want it to be. And this trivially implies the PSNI condition just using the equations of motion of the field. Anything that's localizable here will be localizable in any region down here whose future domain of dependence contains this region. And so SNI, support non-increasing, sits inside this bubble. And again, it contains all the examples I've seen, but there are examples that sit outside SNI but still within the PSNI bubble. So here's one example, and I'm kind of running out of notation now, but what this is meant to stand for is the following scenario where you make a conditional weak measurement of one smeared field down here, and then depending on the result, if it's in some window or not, then you either make a weak measurement of another smear field up here, or you do nothing. And these two regions are such that they're far enough apart in time that every point down here is time-like related to every point up here. This map is PSNI. It's causal. It doesn't enable any superluminal signals, but it is not SNI. Other examples that would sit in here are those from Fuster and Virk's probe formalism. They would be PSNI and causal, but not SNI. Okay, so that's a kind of summary of everything from the last talk and results from this paper. But one thing that's missing from this picture is where do ideal measurements sit? So Sorkin's result is that you have some non-local observable and the corresponding ideal measurement, the result is that it signals. So it's a non-local map, so it sits outside the local bubble, but it's also not causal, so it sits outside here. But the question remains, what about ideal measurements of local observables? Okay, so that's where I'm going to head now. Any questions at this point? Maybe that would be a good point to take a breather. Nope. Oh, yeah. Sure, yeah, I'll just scroll back. So whenever, if you act with EC on some observable B that's not to the past of the region for C, then if EC is PSNI, then the operator you get will be localizable in any region down here that's not to the future of C, such that its future domain of dependence contains the region for B. Okay, so to the reason that we didn't look at ideal measurements in the first instance was that it turned out to be very technically challenging, at least for me. So I feel like it's necessary to go through some background to get to the point where we can describe and talk about the case of ideal measurements. So the first thing to discuss is just projectors in general. Imagine I have some Hermitian operator A on C3, so just a 3x3 matrix. And let's say that it's diagonalizable like this with three distinct eigenvalues and the associated projectors. I'm going to plot its spectrum, which is the whole real, we've got the whole real line here, and its spectrum are the 3 points, 3 eigenvalues. Now, in its eigenbasis, this is just going to be a diagonal matrix with the eigenvalues on the diagonal. And if you want to get back to the original basis, you can just use the matrix formed from the eigenvectors. Now, when we take a function of this matrix, so a function defined from the real numbers to the complex numbers, say, what we mean is we take a function of the eigenvalues on the diagonal, and then if we want to return to the original basis, we use the matrices again formed from the eigenvectors of A. And I want to look at the specific case of an indicator function or a characteristic function. So imagine we have some subset of the real numbers, B, here. And we want to look at the indicator function for that. So that is a function that's just zero up until we get to B, and then is one, and then is zero elsewhere. If we take an indicator function of A, then we're taking an indicator function of the eigenvalues in the eigenbasis. And so you see here, lambda is the only one that sits inside the region where this function is one. And so this will be one, this will be zero, and this will be zero. So we just get this matrix, which is then just the same as the first projector, P1. Okay, so now if we have a subset B that covers the first two eigenvalues, then we're going to get a one here, and a zero here, like that. And that can be written as a sum of the projectors, P1 plus P2. If we have a subset B that doesn't contain any eigenvalues, then all of these evaluate to zero. And so we just get the zero matrix. And so in general, taking an indicator function of the matrix with respect to some subset will give us some sum of the subset of projectors. We can do the same thing even when our operator is unbounded. So I'm imagining here the position operator on square integrable wave functions on the real line. That's an unbounded operator. Its spectrum in this case isn't discrete. It's in fact the entire real line. And we can still do the same thing. We can take an indicator function with respect to some subset of its spectrum. So how does that act? Well, for some square integrable wave function psi, if we take an indicator function of x hat on psi, then explicitly that's just the indicator function of x times by the wave function, which acts to chop off the wave function outside of B. And this is a projector in the same way that it was before, because if we act twice with this, the indicator function on this side will just square to itself, and so the operation is squaring to itself. And actually, this is true more generally for any self-adjoint operator, essentially self-adjoint, given some technically Borel set or subset of the real number line, the indicator function of the operator A with respect to that Borel set is a projector on the Hilbert space. So armed with that, we can then cast the ideal measurement update map into a form that looks more like these, or takes advantage of these indicator functions. So let's go back to the case of the 3x3 matrix A from before, where its spectrum looked like this. It was a discrete spectrum. If I said, write down the update map for an ideal measurement, you'd have something like this, where you sum over the three projectors for these different eigenvalues. And it's acting on some operator X here, as we're in the dual picture. So what we can do is write down three mutually disjoint subsets that cover the real line, B1 to B3, and each cover a single eigenvalue. And then we can recast this ideal measurement map into this form, where we've swapped every projector for an indicator function acting on the operator A. And we can think about these Bs as kind of like bins, where we're binning the outcomes that we get from different measurements. So I could weight the sum here, or
you have parameters lambda.
Yeah, up here.
Where you take where you sum with the factor one and lambda.
So this is the update map that you get from a projective measurement. Okay. You know, when you if I was to look at a measurement where I select on a given outcome, how that acts on the density matrix rho is I hit it with projectors on either side to project onto that outcome, but then I have to normalize it by dividing by trace rho of times the projector.
Yeah, but you could.
Okay. Square rooted, sorry. Yep.
But you don't have to weight them equally, do you?
So maybe I should just write down this on the board. So if I get. I get the outcome lambda I, then the density matrix goes to P I rho P I over.
Lambda I was some arbitrary factor.
Lambda I's, sorry, they're the eigenvalues for this operator. Okay. Yeah.
Completely arbitrary how I label the outcomes of a measurement. If I measure a spin, I could call the outcomes plus one, minus all the state update rule under a measure. They're just conventional.
Okay, that's a definition.
Yeah, I mean, essentially. Essentially follows from the.
It's different if you're calculating the expectation value of the physical quantity.
Yes.
That's a different kind of calculation, but this is the update of the state to actually the joule bit. So it's a different thing from calculating the expectation.
If you had some general, a qubit in some general state, psi, and you were to do an ideal measurement of Z spin, then you get the sum of the projectors onto spin up on either side of the row, plus the sum of the projectors for spin down on either side of the row. So you turn it into a mixed state where it's a equal parts sum of part that spin up and the part that spin down.
It seems to me that I can have a projector P, which is the sum of P1 and P2.
Yeah.
And then if I decide that I have one projector, two projectors, I get two different update maps.
Yes.
So how do I make my choice?
That's great, because that's almost what I was just about to say, which is
it does make a
difference. Yeah.
So that's why this cannot be an update map associated with the operator A. It's associated to something else.
Yes. Yeah. It depends on, your experimental setup in some way. So
that's why I was bugged by the label E of A.
Right. Okay. Yes. So it depends on something else, some information that you're putting into this update map. So here we're imagining that we have these bins with which we can put in each of our different outcomes. Sometimes we'll measure lambda 1 or lambda 2 or lambda 3, and then we're bidding them like this. But thinking about it in this way, we can also cover situations where, let's say, these were energies, and these two energies were so close that we couldn't resolve them with our experimental setup. Then we would want something like this, where we have a bin that we put in the, if we measure lambda 1, we can put it into this bin. But then on the other side, we just have a single bin for both of these two different outcomes of the measurement. So whether or not we get these two energies, we can't distinguish them, so we throw them into the same bin. And in that case, the update map, we now sum over the different bins. We have the indicator function for this bin, and then over here we have the indicator function for this other bin. And in this case, we get something which I think was similar to what you were saying, which is where we have a sum over the two projectors for these two different eigenvalues. And that's what makes sense. That makes sense from our normal thinking or textbook thinking of quantum mechanics. We don't want to project onto the eigenspaces for these two eigenvalues individually. We want to just project onto the total eigenspace, because we can't distinguish between these two outcomes. And so I would think of these bins here as encoding the experimental resolution. They encode something about the apparatus with which we're measuring. In this case, we can't distinguish these two outcomes, whereas in the previous case, we could. And you get different update maps. So really, and what I'll do in a second, is you want to add a subscript or something to this update map that says, oh, we're talking about this experimental resolution. What's more, we can do this in the case of unbounded operators, like the position operator. The spectrum, again, is the entire real line. And let's say we have these bins like this, where we can say whether or not the particle fell or was measured here or it was measured in here. Now let's call these bins Bn. Then the update map in this case is of this form, where we're summing over, let's just say, some indexing set I and the associated indicator functions of x hat for each of these bins. And like I was saying, the bins here encode our experimental resolution. If we had an experiment which was much more accurate and we could pin down the position much more accurately, then we would imagine a lot more smaller bins here. And so for that reason, I was just calling the set of these bins that we specify the resolution R. And then in general, given some resolution R and some self-adjoint operator A, we can then define what we mean by the ideal measurement of A with respect to that resolution. It's just then the sum over some indexing set of the indicator functions of the operator with respect to the bins Bn that are in our resolution. And I'm also going to add some specific notation in this case, where we have E with the subscripts, A for the operator and R for the resolution.
Maybe this is where you're going. This is a part of the discussion which is very familiar to what people do when you talk about the renormalization group, where you have a semi-group structure, because you have an inclusion. You have a partial order on these resolution sets.
And yeah.
There's a
partial order on the resolution sets.
Yeah.
Like then, the if
yeah,
the,
one is bigger than the other, one is smaller, so you have an inclusion. You have a partial order,
mm-hmm.
And then the algae flow is exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So by the partial order, you're thinking if I had two different resolutions where all the bins for one fit into some of the bins for the other. Okay. Yeah? Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. That's something good to think about. Okay. So I was saying that this is possible for an unbounded operator, and that now includes the case of a smeared field operator in quantum field theory. The smeared field operators, the basic observables in the theory, are unbounded just like the position operator. And so we can talk about ideal measurements of them in this way, provided we specify some resolution. And the resolution in this case is going to be bins within which we bin our outcomes for what the smeared field value is when we make the measurement. like I said at the beginning, I want to just, now that we've written the ideal measurements in that way, I'm going to kind of cast them in this general form of a Krauss operation, because it'll be easy then to talk about, or slightly easier to talk about, the question of causality. So here are the kind of three examples that I've given in this talk for different update maps. I mean, there are infinitely more, but here are just three examples. So we have the ideal measurement map, unitary picks, and weak measurements. And I've written them like this so that they kind of look similar, in that on either side of X, the operator that we're acting on, we have functions of A. Here we've got indicator functions, exponential, and Gaussian functions. And in each one, we have a kind of sum, or a continuous sum in this case, or just no sum at all. So I'm just going to formalize that and talk about a Krauss operation with A. And to do that, we first specify a labeling set. In this case, it's just this indexing set I. In this case, there's only one thing on either side of X. So it's just a trivial, like, singleton set. I'm just going to call that little gamma. And then in the final case, it's the real line that we're integrating over here. Just to be technical about it, or pedantic, we also have to specify some non-negative measure nu so that we can do these sums or integrals. In the top case, it's the counting measure to get the sum. In this case, it's just one. We only have one thing. And in this case, it's the Lebesgue measure, just the standard measure on R, so we can get this d alpha. And then the meat of the Krauss operation is we specify some Krauss functions from the real numbers to the complex numbers, which are labeled by the little gammas that are in our labeling set. So in the first case, the Krauss functions are indicator functions of lambda, labeled by n, which on this side gives us the different bins bn. In this case, we just have one element in the labeling set, so that kind of drops out on the right-hand side, but the Krauss functions then are just complex exponentials. And then finally, we have Gaussians, where the label is this real parameter alpha. And writing them all in this way, or we can then express them all of these maps, like this, where we're integrating over this labeling set gamma with our measure, and then putting these Krauss operators on either side of X. But the kind of the special thing to note here is that these Krauss operators are written as functions of the operator A. So so in that sense, I'm saying this is a Krauss operation with A. And I'm also going to just put in into the notation the comma kappa to remind us what sort of functions we're actually dealing with. I mean, if I were to be really verbose, I would also put in the gamma and the nu into this notation. OK, so that's what I mean by a general Krauss operation. And with that, then, we can get a nice clean causality condition on maps like this. So, and in the specific case that we have a smeared field operator, the generators of the algebra. OK, so given our Krauss functions, or whatever Krauss operation we're dealing with, if we compute this thing for some real number t, or for any real number t, I'm calling it kappa tilde here, where it's an integral of kappa times kappa complex conjugated, but with the argument here shifted by t, we can also think of that as a L2 inner product on this space gamma with the measure nu, then this thing is going to be able to tell us quickly whether or not a map is causal or is not causal. So here's the condition explicitly. If this kappa tilde is a constant function of its first argument, lambda, for all t, then for any smeared field, i.e. for any test function, the corresponding Krauss operation is S and I. That's the support non-increasing, the kind of strongest causality condition. And so you'll never get a signal for any state that you try, even the ones that we were worried about were potentially, you know, constructed from some other a-causal operation. And so such Krauss operations are then physically realizable, at least in principle. On the other hand, if kappa is not a constant function of its first argument for some t, then for any smear field 5f, if we have these assumptions, which I'm just calling abs for Ifa, Biola, and Sorkin, I'll talk about them in a second, then the associated Krauss operation signals specifically in the ground state of the theory. So in omega, we don't now have to appeal to, oh, it'll signal in some state, which potentially is an aphysical state itself. We can actually show that this operation will give us a superluminal signal in the ground state.
So can you explain what the sentence, if it is the signal in the ground state? You're going to explain that. Right?
So going back to this condition of causality before, where a map could or may or may not enable a signal between the two parties, Ifa and Biola, that's the signal that I'm talking about.
Where does it need to signal in the ground state?
So, yes, okay, yeah, I should say that. So we had this condition from before. I'll draw a little picture as well. Where these two regions were space-like from one another. And then one of the condition of a signal between Ifa and Biola was that this expectation value is equal to the expectation value you would get if you didn't have Ifa's actions at all.
That's the condition of no signal.
That's the condition of no signal, yeah. And so when this is violated, you have a signal. And I'm saying here that it's violated specifically if you put in rho equals omega. The ground state.
Your omega here is a quasi-free state.
Yes. Yeah.
So, is it like, could it be the Fock vector or it doesn't be a ground state?
Sorry?
It could be the Fock vector?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
It doesn't have to be generating. It's not a thermal state.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and it might be, there might be a simple way to generalize this so that I'm not talking about the ground state and separating and whatnot, that you could get it easily for any quasi-free state. But actually, I haven't tried that, so that's a good point.
So if I understand, so this E phi f k, that's the cross operation you have associated with this function k.
And with the smear field phi of f, yeah.
With your exponential I phi.
No, that was a specific operation.
Oh, specific
yeah,
operation.
Yeah.
And then when you mean if ABS, you mean what?
These are assumptions that I haven't told you what they are yet, okay. And I will get to those. But they're somewhat generic assumptions, but it's worth stating what they are because of the results that we're getting here. Yep.
I just want to get clear on this ground state because you haven't sort of stipulated some component field theory. Are you saying that? For the quantum field operators, that this we're talking about vacuum at all points. Are you saying vacuum relative to the mode associated with this test function f? Is that what you mean?
We could say it's slightly more general than this. But you could say it's the vacuum for at all points. So the vacuum across all space. But actually, when you're going through the calculation, all you require is that it just looks like the vacuum locally. That is, all the expectation values and probabilities you can compute in your local region of space-time, you know, its domain of dependence and everything, they will be the same as if you had the global vacuum state. So there can be other stuff going on in the state elsewhere, just as long as locally you've got the vacuum. Okay, so what this means then is that for any smear field phi of f, if we have these assumptions abs, then the associated Krauss operation with phi of f and the particular choice of kappa is not physically realizable because it's going to enable a superluminal. Okay, let me just go through some examples to, I don't know, showcase the utility of this condition. If we look at the unitary kick map from before, where we hit x on either side with this unitary, then in this case, the kappa was simply e to the I lambda, and there's only one element in the labeling set, so we don't really have to think about that or the integral in this case. And so if we come to calculate kappa tilde, we don't even have an integral, we're just multiplying kappa by the shifted kappa, complex conjugated. We have this, which then simplifies to e to the I t in this case, and that is not a function of lambda, so it's a constant function for all t, and hence we don't have a signal, which is what we saw before. This map sat in the region, the causal bubble in the Venn diagram. So on the other hand, if we look at the map where we have phi of f squared, and the only thing that changes here is that kappa is now e to the I lambda squared. We then calculate this condition, or this kappa tilde, we get this function, which is not constant in lambda. And so if we have these abs, wherever they are, then this update map will enable a signal, a superluminal one, in the ground state. And so it's not physically realizable. And so, yeah, it's quite quick to, you don't have to do any quantum field theory now that you have this condition, and we can apply this now to the case that we're interested in, which is that of ideal measurements. I should say as well, specifically of the basic observables in the theory, the smeared field operators. So it's a little bit complicated. So like I was saying before, for an ideal measurement, you have to specify some resolution. The bins on the spectrum, so here they are. The kappas, in this case, are indicator functions with respect to these different bins. And so if you go to calculate this kappa tilde, the integral over lambda with this measure just becomes a sum over the different ends in this indexing set. And if I then put in the specific form of kappa over here, I get these two indicator functions of lambda. And actually, this sum can then just be rewritten as a single indicator function of a set R of t, which is explicitly given like this. But I'm going to unpack that visually now. So how do we get this set? We take the bins and we shift them by t like this. And then we do a pairwise intersection of those bins like this. And after doing that intersection, you'd see this intersected with this, we get this bin. This intersected with this, we get this bin, and so on. And this resulting set is our R of t. And it should be clear that an indicator function with respect to this set is not constant. The indicator function would be 1, 0, 1, 0, and so on. It's not a constant function in this axis. And so we would get a signal in this case, provided we have these abs assumptions. So that's kind of easy to see in this case for these bins, but a lot of the hard work took a long time, for me anyway, was to show that this kappa tilde is constant not just for some basic resolutions like this, but for all possible resolutions you could write down, because maybe it's the case that there's some particular way of measuring a smeared field that would not give you a signal. We just have to find that type of resolution. And the space of resolutions is vast. You can come up with things where the bins aren't nice little intervals, but instead are so-called fat Cantor sets, which are Cantor sets of non-zero measure, and their complements and things like that. And then you've got to shift them over each other some arbitrary amount and see what you get out. But anyway, we could show that. So the statement is that kappa tilde is not a constant function for any resolution that you can write down. And hence, for any smeared field, If we have these ABS assumptions, then an ideal measurement of that smeared field for any resolution gives you a superluminal signal in the ground state, and hence is not physically realizable. Okay, so what are these ABS assumptions? A stands for IFA, and we're saying that IFA can kick with a smeared field. So they have this operation from before, the unitary kick with respect to some smeared field. We're just going to say that that is allowed. It was an operation that was both local and causal, so it was in principle physically realizable. That's some justification for allowing it. Also, we had this idea in our heads of how it could be implemented physically with applying this external field or coupling an external field into the Lagrangian. So that's just, I guess, some justification for this assumption. Our B is for the assumption that Biola can measure a smeared field in some way and determine this expectation value over here. So it should be clear that we're not assuming that Biola can measure a smeared field with an ideal measurement, because that's what we're in the end testing for Quiva. But there are ways to talk about ideal measurements of, measurements of smeared fields, the weak measurements, for example, that are completely causal. And from those, you can actually write down a way in which someone could, say, do some sample of 1,000, 10,000 measurements, and then reconstruct or estimate this expectation value. So that's, I guess, some justification for that assumption. It's also hard to imagine what you could do with the theory if you didn't allow us to get out things like this. You know, if you can't get out expectation values of operators in the theory. And finally, the S is for the Sorkin scenario. We're assuming that we can form that scenario that we started with, where we have Quiva's ideal measurement of the smeared field in here, and then we have Biola's smeared field up here and IFA's smeared field down here, and these two have supports which are mutually space-like. And then both these two are time-like related to the middle one. We're also assuming in this scenario that the Pauli-Jordan function between these two is non-zero and between these two is non-zero. And in general, I think that's true for examples that I've tried, but I haven't been able to prove that will always be true in some generic globally hyperbolic spacetime. yes, so this kind of scenario might look like it's always possible. And indeed, in Minkowski spacetime or spacetimes with non-compact spatial slices, you can always form something like this. But there are counterexamples. So specifically, if we have the measurement region for Quiva in the middle, if it is what I'm just calling transitive, then we don't get the Sorkin scenario. So I'll explain that with an example. If you think of the cylinder spacetime, where we have space as a circle cross time, and if Quiva's region in the middle is this kind of slab of the cylinder between these two dotted lines, and it's long enough such that light has time to travel all the way around the cylinder, then you can never form a Sorkin scenario, because every IFA down here and every Biola up here, because this region is so long, they're always going to be time-like related. You can never get the IFA and Biola being space-like. And so in this example, you wouldn't run into any issues with causality. And maybe that kind of makes sense, because you've given the whole measurement enough time for everything to talk to one another, and all causality considerations have essentially been washed out. Another example that it feels like it's worth noting is if you take a single point in a discrete spacetime. So rather than have a continuum, if we imagine some sprinkled causal set, and just for convenience, I've put it into 1+1 Minkowski, then for a single point I, you can't form a Sorkin scenario. This is where we're measuring, because every point to the past here is time-like related to every point to the future of I. So any IFA down here will be time-like related to any Biola up here. And in a discrete spacetime, the field operator at a point exists. It's a real operator in the theory. Whereas in the continuum, it's technically an operator value distribution, and we have to integrate it over some region. And so that means we can, in the discrete case, or in some regular lattice even, talk about ideal measurements of fields at a point. Now, if we had two points that are space-like, like I and J, and we have some smeared field in the discrete case, it would just be some linear combination of the two operators, then now we do have to worry again about the potential Sorokin scenario and then the resulting superluminal signals that we would get from measuring, ideally measuring this kind of smear field. Okay, so yeah, under these assumptions, ideal measurements of smeared fields are then not physical, and so that maybe brings up the question of whether the projection postulate is the right way to think about measurements in quantum field theory. So some key points to kind of explain what I'm saying and what I'm not saying. This one I've already actually said, so we do get signals in the causal set case or in a discrete space-time case if the support of the smear field is not this transitive. So for example, the pair of space-like points. In the continuum theory, I just want to state again that I've only looked at ideal measurements of the smear field operators. So they are the basic, you know, the generators of the algebra, but it could be the case that there are some more complicated operators out there in the theory for which the ideal measurements of them don't give you this signal, this superluminal signal. And hence operators for which the projection postulate is still a valid way to describe measurements of. maybe I should also point out that having no projection postulate in quantum field theory doesn't necessarily mean no projection postulate in the non-relativistic systems that we're all, you know, the projection postulate does quite a good job of describing measurements in a certain regime in non-relativistic systems. And this is because we could imagine that there might actually be some other causally consistent update map at the level of the quantum field theory that when we take a non-relativistic limit becomes in some sense the projection postulate that we see in non-relativistic systems. And then finally, I guess I'll just remind people that in both continuum and discrete cases, we didn't have to even use the ideal measurement update map. We can describe measurements of smeared fields in ways that are always causal, e.g. these weak measurement update maps of smeared fields. And actually, there are infinitely many update maps that are completely causal. If instead of a Gaussian in the weak measurement, we put any square integrable function, that gives us a causal map. So maybe they are a better route to go down instead of the projection postulate. Okay, so that is everything. And here's just the summary that I guess I could just put up. I mean, I've said all these things, so I don't need to say them again, but I'll just leave this up. Yeah, thank you.
And kind of what the most general result of this type you could hope for is. So maybe I'm just kind of trying to organize all the various ways in which you particularize the problem. So you could have imagined a measurement that wasn't projective.
Yep.
POVM measurement. And for every POVM measurement, there are again sort of many update maps associated with it, like the elements of this. I think they call it an instrument sometimes. You know, they just have to, when acting on identity, reproduce the effect, but there's lots of ways of doing that. And then even within the projective cases, you can imagine lots of different update maps. And then furthermore, you could run the scope beyond the particular smear field operators.
Yep.
But there was a point where you were saying, here's a condition on the Krauss operators that characterizes causality. Those are the Krauss operators for what kind of map that you'd already assumed the smeared field at that point?
Yes, yeah, so on that slide, yeah, maybe that was a bit hidden, but
okay.
It was
kind of like, I want to understand that result as like, what has been stipulated and what has been relaxed? I kind of missed that.
I think it's the next one. Yeah, so it's a condition specifically for smeared fields.
Okay.
So we have this Krauss operation, which is just some very general way of writing down an update map, where we have kappa functions of the operator, which could be whatever. And then specifically for the case of a smeared field, then we have this condition. So, I mean, I guess it's sort of in there here when we're saying for any smeared field, this is what happens.
So let me see if I've understood kind of what happened in this part of your talk. Maybe I got it wrong, but if I just had a measurement with three outcomes. Say, all right, well, there's the update map where I project onto each outcome, but there's also the update map where I coarse grain the first two,
yeah,
and I destroy the coherence between the first two and the third, but then there's the map where I destroy the coherence between the first and the the second. And then in this field theoretic context, there's sort of a greater variety of sort of update maps that I can do for a given projective measurement. And that's roughly sort of the space we're in here, where we're talking about that variety of ways of course graining up results and preserving coherence.
Yes. Yeah. I would say in the non-relativistic context, if we're just talking about projective measurements, then it's the same variety in that you could write down any resolution, any set of these Borel sets. It's just that in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, you end up with only so many resolutions that are actually different from each other in the sense of whether or not they contain or don't contain the eigenvalues of the operators that you're measuring. But for unbounded operators, which do appear in non-relativistic systems, the position operator, it seems like there's more variety there in the projectors that might appear in the ideal measurement update map. Because for every such resolution you can imagine, even the ones with the crazy Cantor sets and things, you'll get projectors, provided the bins are of non-zero measure. So, yeah. And that's the same as in the smeared field case, because position operator, smeared field operator, they both look kind of similar mathematically. They're unbounded and one.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, was there another question? Yeah, you can.
Yeah, okay.
We do have a question online.
Okay.
Takato, do you want to ask?
Yes. I have a question regarding to the cutoff. So in ordinary, so I think here you're concerned free scalar or maybe interacting scalar. I'm not sure.
Free.
Which you?
It's a free theory.
Free.
Yeah.
And how did you avoid the problem of UV divergence? I mean the. My motivation comes from interacting case. So if you just stick with this free theory case, maybe there is no problem. But so if you involve some interaction, there are some UV divergence coming from loop calculations. And I think this is related to the problem of resolution. And the second reason I'm also interested in the cutoff stuff is so if you introduce some cutoff, it means the description of the theory is only valid up to some scale. And in general, we usually allow non-local interactions present in the effective action, which is valid up to some scale. So do you have any comment on that? I didn't see the connection to these stuff. So.
I haven't added an interaction here. So I wouldn't know what happens or how to go about dealing with any UV divergences. But the next thing that you said about having some scale where you allow whatever non-local terms below some scale or something, maybe if one had a certain scale where they weren't allowed to go below, then you could avoid these issues of causality by saying something, I guess it's similar to the discrete space-time case. If you only if you stuck to smeared fields or something that were smaller than your discreteness scale, then it would be very much like the discrete case where you're measuring an operator, a field, smeared field operator at a point. Maybe that's a way to avoid the issue of signaling. But no, I've not looked into any of that in detail.
I see. Okay. Yes, thank you.
Following up on Rob's question, this is a slide where cross operations could be of any of the types, right? Because you generalize.
Yes. Yeah.
As long as you have a smeared field. So, is the problem with the ideal measurements that they always fall into the second category?
Yes. Yeah. That's the summary.
Okay. Good. Thinking about the original Sorkin kind of result that inspired all this, so there's no states. It's a sort of general result, it's not state specific. So could you say a little bit more about what motivated you to like think about states?
The ground state, you mean?
Or just like, why? Because it seems like everything else is just with the operators, and it's and so why exactly are states coming in here, and what role are they playing?
Okay, yeah. So I guess the motivation for just sticking to the ground state first is simplicity. It was allowed me to get the technical result that I needed here. But also, there was a worry that I was kind of suggesting or indicating at earlier that some states in the theory might be aphysical themselves. So I don't want to, you know, the previous condition of causality that I put up from my previous paper, maybe you might worry that that's not the right condition because you're asking for so-and-so to be true for every state. But if you've got some states that are aphysical, maybe you don't want to ask that kind of a condition. And so here I was like, wait, I'll just stick to one state that people will probably be happy with, the ground state, and see if I can derive a signal for sure in that state and not appeal to, well, you know that there exists some state out there for which get a signal.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this comes in because of your former condition is just applying to some states, but doesn't apply to all states.
Former condition, sorry.
So the condition.
The first causality condition. That's coming from asking for that equality to be satisfied for all states rho or for all density matrices rho.
Okay.
And here we're essentially only interested in one row. If it works or that it doesn't work for that one row. We're not testing it for all rows or hoping that there exists some row for which it fails.
Oh, I see. So it's just an easier way of proving that your causality condition.
Yeah.
Just focus on one state that we care about rather than proving that it holds for all states.
Yeah, and I guess in this case maybe it's stronger as a condition in that sense because we're not saying that there exists some row. We actually know what the row is explicitly.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks. Did you have a question?
It's sort of a bit tangential but related to the online question. Do you have any thoughts about like how you might do this for gauge theories where you don't necessarily have local observables?
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I had more thoughts about that. The route I've started to try and go down with that is through AQFT. But I'm really not an expert on the AQFT approach to gauge theory. I've tried to learn a bit, and the best thing I was able to get a handle on so far was it's actually really close in form to the real scalar field theory case. We're thinking we take whatever field theory or classical field that we're talking about, vector valued, whatever. And as long as it's the equations of motion are green hyperbolic so that we can get the...
you need to pick a gauge.
Yes. Yeah. So that's the cases that I've looked at so far. And that certainly might not cut it for some people. But yeah, no, if people know more about that, please. Okay. Yeah.
I guess the other comment is that this is sort of, in AQFT, one of the key things is that you have this inclusion of the algebra of observables when you have inclusion of causally connected regions kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you phrase this kind of map and measurements in terms of that inclusion?
Do you mean like when you have, say, a subalgebra for some region and it sits inside a subalgebra? Yeah, so... these maps are maps on the algebra. So the way that I think it was phrased in my original paper was in talking about how the subalgebras fit inside each other once you act with one of these maps. Yeah. And that is a nice natural way to think about it. And the PSNI condition that I referred to before, that's basically how I was phrasing it. There's still more to be thought about there because some of the things I was saying about the maps that if you have EA and EC and they are in space-like regions, the EA and EC commute, you can compose them in either order. That's true if we're talking about maps that are constructed from operators A and C, like these Krauss ones, but for just some general maps which you can write down which might not necessarily be constructed from the operators in theory, then it's not clear whether they commute in that nice way. And so yeah, there's more to think about. Like what is the abstract or algebraic structure of update maps in a generic QFT.
Thank you.
Cheers. Yeah.
I guess it's a follow-up on Doreen's question. So you said you restricted yourself. accepted the ground state, I'm thinking how important that precision actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Because naively, I would expect that this property on the browse operators is really just due to the algebra of observables, which is state independent. So
yeah.
How exactly does this state come into this result?
Yeah, okay. I think you're probably right that you could derive this for some other, or you could derive a signal for some other state, provided the kappa tilde is not constant, so that you're in this side of things. but yeah, I think then that comes back to, it was just easier to pick the ground state and show that it gave a signal in that case. So
the theory is signaling in any state, so that's reason to reject it.
Yeah, so I guess once you find the ground state one, you can then say, I'm not going to bother doing more maths. But that is, yeah, yeah. And that's something that I should do, or anybody. Yeah, yeah.
So the technical talk was very interesting. I don't know a lot about this, maybe the question is naive, but I come from like a causal modeling perspective,
mm-hmm.
where we typically start with some sort of graph, and then we have like ABC in some ways, and typically we say, okay, maybe there's like a hidden set row inferencing some of them, or like transfer source. It seems that there you have like all very good tools to formulate statements, like what does it mean for a distribution to be achievable, if the causal mechanisms are actually some sort of causality respecting maps on some sort of maybe ground state of some 3D,
mm-hmm.
And you associate each party to some bounding region of space-time and so on.
Yeah.
So would you find that interesting? And also, do you expect there to be differences in terms of like how much correlations you can achieve? Like, can you get it back to us bound for the CHSA scenario where you have Einstein Bob? Like, can you get in this sort of framework?
The first question was, is that interesting?
Yeah.
Yes, is the answer. yeah. And then the next question,
could you think of a classical and quantum gaps, right? Like,
right, yeah.
Like quantum and QFT gaps?
Yeah. So the only thing I've really thought about in that context is a Bell theorem type mm-hmm. scenario. But that doesn't quite fit this bill, because in that case, you're thinking about, you're doing two measurements in space-like regions, or you hope they're space-like, and you're just looking at the correlations to get the bounds. And so if we were modeling that in this kind of a scenario, we've got two non-conditional update, ideal measurement update maps. So it would be like EA and EC. They're the two sides of the Bell experiment, and they're space-like to one another. And so all we're really saying there is that it doesn't matter which order you compose them in. I guess because, yeah, we're not looking at correlations here between the results of different measurements. This is a case of if Cuiva in the middle is doing these non-conditional measurements where they don't post-select on anything. Because we want to model the situation where they do not communicate anything to Aoife and Viola. And so for that reason, maybe it's a bit different, but yeah, I don't know. It's a whole avenue I haven't
okay.
Cheers.
In that case, well, thank the speaker very much, and take other
questions. Cheers. Thanks.